kids from how well known they are at the top to how unknown they are. I will just be giving a summary of each of these cases. So starting at the top level with the most famous cases, we have Madeleine McCann. On May 3rd, 2007, Jerry and Kate McCann were on holiday in Praia de Luz, Portugal, with their three children, Madeleine, who was 3 years old, and twins, Sean and Amelie, who were two. At 8:30 p.m., a couple went to meet friends for dinner at a bar in the resort they were all staying at. Children were sleeping in the apartment about 100 feet away, and the parents came in to check on them every 30 minutes. When Kate returned to check on them at around 10 p.m., she discovered Madeleine's bed was empty and she had gone. An extensive investigation across Europe has cost the British government over £13 million. Some theories say she was kidnapped by a stranger, a pedophile, or human traffickers. Another theory is she wandered outside by herself and had some sort of accident by either drowning in the ocean, falling into a deep trench dug by road workers, or run over by a local driver who panicked and buried her body somewhere. The most controversial explanation is that Madeleine accidentally died when she was sedated by her parents. Some believe that the parents gave all the kids sedatives to keep them asleep while they all went out for dinner. Kate and Jerry were afraid of being blamed for her death, so they faked an abduction. They refused to take a polygraph test, but they say they have nothing to hide. They did admit the children were left unattended and the apartment was unlocked, so anybody could have entered or exited. 10 months after Maddie's disappearance, the McCanns were losing hope in the Portuguese police's handling of the case. So they hired a team of ex-MI5 detectives to run a parallel investigation. Their report focused on a sighting by an Irish family, the Smiths, who saw a man carrying a child at about 10 p.m. the day Madeleine went missing. The team travelled to Ireland to interview the family and produced e-vids of the man they saw. Their report said the Smiths were helpful and sincere, and concluded, "The Smith sighting is credible evidence of a sighting of Maddie and more credible than Jane Tanner's sighting." This refers to a different sighting of a man seen at 9:15 p.m. by Jane Tanner, a friend of the McCanns who was with them at the bar. She saw a man carrying a girl just yards from the apartment as she went to check on her own children. But this was dismissed by the MI5 team after serious inconsistencies were found in her evidence. Their report also raised questions about anomalies in the statements given by the McCanns and their friends. One explanation could be that they were all more drunk than they would like to admit. Jerry and Kate felt the detectives were being overly critical of them and their friends. Maybe they thought the report painted them in a bad light, and so they buried it. For 5 whole years, all the information the private team had collected was suppressed by the McCanns, who threatened legal action against them if they reported. as well as questioning the McCann story. The reports contained information about Madeline's sleeping patterns and raised the possibility that she could have died in an accident after leaving the apartment herself from one of the two unlocked doors. There was also an uncomfortable complication with the Smith's account. Mr. Smith had originally told the police that he recognized something about the way Jerry McCann carried one of his children, which reminded him of the man he had seen in prior to this. But Smith has since said that he does not believe the man he saw was Jerry. Next is Amelia Earhart. She was the first female aviator to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean in 1928. Amelia continued to reach new heights and set records. In 1937, at nearly 40 years old, she was ready for a final challenge. She wanted to be the first woman to fly around the world. On June 1st, Amelia and her navigator, Fred Noonan, departed from Miami. Over the following weeks, they made various stops to refuel before reaching Ley, New Guinea, on June 29th. From here, they had 7,000 miles left to go. Their next stop was Howland Island, which they departed for on July 2nd. This flight was expected to be difficult to navigate, since the maps were often inaccurate, and also the island was tiny, at half a mile wide. It didn't help that the weather was cloudy. Amelia was in contact with the US Coast Guard and asked them to take bearings on her. They sent transmissions, but she could not hear them. Her radio transmissions were faint or interrupted with static. At 7:42 a.m., the Coast Guard picked up her message. "We must be on you, but we cannot see you. Fuel is running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at 1,000 feet. The Coast Guard tried to reply, but she didn't seem to hear. At 8:45 a.m., Amelia reported, "We are running north and south." And that was the last message they heard from her. One theory is the plane crashed about 100 miles from the island, and an extensive ocean search was undertaken to find Amelia and Fred. However, after 2 weeks, the operation was called off, and the pair was declared lost at sea. The official report by US government is that they had crashed into the Pacific Ocean. Two more searches were carried out to no avail. Another main theory is that Amelia may have actually landed safely on another small island called Nikumaroro. The reasoning is that in one of her final radio transmissions, Amelia said, "We are on the line 157337. The Coast Guard received this but could not locate her from the signal. However, if Amelia was correct, this means that she was traveling along a path where one direction would lead to the vast ocean and the opposite way would lead to Nikumaroro Island. Over the next 10 days, radio operators received 121 messages. At least 57 of those could have been from Amelia's plane, though it could not be confirmed. But they were able to get the locations on 6 of those transmissions, 4 of which were nearby to Nikumaroro. The tide would eventually wash the plane Investigators believe the pair survived and returned to the US under new names for security reasons. There are many verbal testimonies that Amelia and Fred landed on the tiny Marshall Island of Millie, but others believe this theory is not plausible because the Marshall Islands were too far away for them to reach with the amount of fuel they had left. Okay, next up is Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Another missing airplane flight, but this time much more recent. The disappearance of the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, carrying 239 passengers and crew, is one of the world's biggest aviation mysteries. The plane took off on March 8, 2014 at 12:41 a.m. from Kuala Lumpur and headed for Beijing. The plane was going the usual route, about to enter Vietnamese airspace over the South China Sea, when at 1:21 a.m. the communications to air traffic control switched off. The final message from the cockpit was, "Good night, Malaysian 370. A few minutes later, the plane had turned around, flying back towards Malaysia. The Malaysian military radar was tracking it, but lost the signal at 2:22 a.m. with the plane over the Andaman Sea. A satellite in orbit over the Indian Ocean received hourly signals from Flight 370 and last detected the plane at 8:11 a.m. Based on the final signal, although the exact location couldn't be pinpointed, it was concluded that the flight crashed in the remote part of the Indian Ocean, 1,500 miles southwest of Australia. It was extremely unlikely that anyone on board survived. The first piece of debris was found over a year later, in July 2015, when part of a right wing was discovered on a beach on the French island of Reunion. In 2017, the Malaysian government called off the searches. Its final report said it was unlikely to be mechanical malfunction, and the change in flight path was done manually. However, investigators could not determine why Flight 370 disappeared, and the government has been accused of not releasing all their information. Malaysian air traffic control was found to have violated procedures, as it was over 5 hours before they sent a distress signal alert for the missing plane. Theories ranged from mechanical failure to pilot suicide. Hijacking was ruled out since no group claimed responsibility, and it's unlikely they'd choose to fly to the southern Indian Ocean. The fact that signals had been switched off from inside the aircraft suggested suicide by one of the crew. However, the behavior of the captain and crew prior to the flight did not seem suspicious. Some speculated the plane was shot down, but no evidence of shrapnel from a missile or other projectiles had been found. In 2021, recent findings from British aerospace engineer Richard Godfrey pilot was following a route he had plotted on a flight simulator found at his home. Godfrey also discovered that the pilot put the plane into a 22-minute holding pattern over the coastline of Sumatra, Indonesia, before continuing south. By the way, a holding pattern is when an aircraft is instructed to continue flying in circles while waiting to land. The captain was a supporter of the Malaysian opposition and an acquaintance of its leader, Anwar Ibrahim. The day before the 370 flight, Anwar was sentenced to 5 years in jail on sodomy charges that his supporters believed were bogus and politically motivated. Godfrey believes that the pilot may have attempted to negotiate and was released during the 22 minutes of circling. He suggested maybe somehow that negotiation went wrong and he ended up flying to the remotest part of the southern Indian Ocean. Although this theory is mostly speculation, it may be the closest we get to the truth. Okay, next is Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy Hoffa was an American labor union leader who was president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters for 14 years. Jimmy played a vital role in the growth of the organization, which went from 75,000 members to a million within 2 decades. He was involved with organized crime, which he used throughout his career to strengthen the Teamsters Union until it backfired. At age 44, Jimmy took over presidency. 7 years later, he was convicted for attempted bribery, conspiracy, and 3 counts of fraud for misusing the Teamsters Pension Fund. He was sentenced to 13 years, but was released after 5, on the condition that he would no longer engage in the management of any labor organization. He was even awarded $1.75 million. By the Teamsters Retirement Fund. In today's money, that is $26 million. Jimmy wanted to regain power in the organization, but faced great resistance. This included opposition from several members of the Mafia. One of them was Anthony Provenzano, who had once been his friend, but became an enemy after an argument in prison. Jimmy asked for his support, but Anthony refused, threatening to pull out Jimmy's guts and kidnap his grandchildren. At least 2 of Anthony's union opponents had been murdered, and others who had spoken against him were assaulted. Other Mafia members who became involved were the Jackalone brothers, Tony and Vito, who had made visits to Jimmy's home. Their purpose was to set up a peace meeting between Anthony and Jimmy. Jimmy's son, James, said, "Dad was pushing so hard to get back in office. I was afraid that the mob would do something about it." James was convinced that this peace meeting was a pretext for them setting him up for a hit, since Jimmy had been increasingly uneasy each time the Jackalone brothers arrived. On July 30, 1975, Jimmy went out to a meeting with the brothers, scheduled for 2 p.m. at the Mattress Red Fox restaurant. He left his home at 1:15 p.m. and stopped at the office of his close friend, Louis Lindo, when he was out for lunch. Louis had also become Jimmy's secretary and arranged a previous dinner meeting with the Jackalone brothers 4 days before. About his wife from a payphone behind the restaurant, saying he'd been stood up and that he'd be home at 4 p.m. Witnesses saw Jimmy standing by his car in the parking lot. It is believed that he left the location without a struggle at 2:45 p.m. One witness reported seeing him in the back of a maroon Lincoln or Mercury car with three other people. At 7 a.m. the next day, Jimmy's wife called her son and daughter to say their father had not come home. Louis went to the restaurant and found Jimmy's unlocked car in the parking lot, a maroon 1975 Mercury, which belonged to Tony Giacalone's son, was brought in as evidence. Police dogs identified Jimmy's scent inside the car. It had been borrowed earlier that day by Charles O'Brien to deliver fish. Charles was Jimmy's foster son, but their relationship had soured in previous years. It's believed he was involved in Jimmy's disappearance. Anthony and the Giacalone brothers denied having scheduled the meeting, the details of which Jimmy had written on his office calendar. They all gave alibis, and it was concluded they were not near the restaurant that afternoon. After extensive surveillance and bugging, investigators found that the Mafia members who they thought were involved would not talk about Jimmy's disappearance, even in private. A witness identified three men who were close associates of Anthony Provenzano, but no one has been charged. A lead FBI agent said, "I am comfortable, I know who did it, but it's never going to be prosecuted because we would have to divulge informants and confidential sources." Not drop. George believed she committed suicide after her writing career had failed. Some family and friends thought it was suicide due to her failing relationship with George. There was an illegal abortion clinic operating in Pennsylvania where numerous women had gone missing. A doctor at this clinic claimed another doctor told him Dorothy died there after complications from the procedure, and her body was burned in the furnace. The district attorney believed this, but Dorothy's father said it was ridiculous and absolutely untrue. Over 5 years later, in 1916, a felon, Edward Glenorris, told a prison guard he was paid to bury the body of a woman in December 1910. An acquaintance known as Little Louis hired him, and they met with two other men, one of which fit George Griscom's description, the unconscious woman, who Little Louis said was Dorothy. Driven to a house in New Jersey. The next day she was buried in the cellar after the men said she had died during an operation. Edward was also able to identify a ring that Dorothy was wearing. However, when interviewed by police, Edward denied knowing anything. Manager, a break. for training purposes only and was not actually open. The fact it was pitch black with heavy rain and strong winds made it extremely risky. The FBI speculated he did not survive. However, if he did die, why was he never reported missing? There have been many suspects who have all since passed away. In 2016, after 45 years, the FBI suspended active investigation, and it remains the only unsolved air piracy in commercial aviation history. The next case is Mary Celeste. In December 1872, an American merchant ship named Mary Celeste was found drifting in the Atlantic Ocean. There was nobody on board and no sign of a struggle. None of those who had been on board were ever seen or heard from again. The cargo was 1,700 barrels of denatured alcohol, which was undisturbed, as well as the captain's and crew's personal belongings. Plenty of food in the storage. The missing crew included Captain Benjamin Briggs, his wife and youngest child, plus 7 crew members. The crew were all highly respected and experienced sailors, handpicked by the captain. 1 month before, on November 7th, they departed from New York City and were headed for Genoa, Italy. Another ship, named De Gratia, followed the same route 8 days later and found the deserted Mary Celeste on December 4th. The sails were partly set and the lifeboat was missing. There was about 1 meter of water in the hold, which is a large but not threatening amount for a ship of this size. In the ship's daily log, the final entry was dated 9 days before. The coordinates given were 400 miles away from where it was found. Although disheveled, the ship was working perfectly fine, and there was no apparent reason why the crew would abandon it. Some had suspected it was an attempted insurance fraud, but this was disregarded with no evidence. Was very unlikely, since nothing was stolen and there was no sign of violence. Another theory is they incorrectly measured the amount of water that had accumulated inside due to a malfunction with equipment, believing the ship had taken on too much water and was going to sink. Experts generally agree that some extraordinary and alarming circumstance must have occurred. Several times in the daily log, it mentions rumbling and small explosions from the hold. Cargoes of petroleum naturally give off explosive gas, and these sounds are common. The theory is there was a more intense explosion when a sailor went below deck with a light or a lit cigar. In a panic, they all withdrew into the lifeboat. A similar theory says there may have been an earthquake on the seabed, causing the captain to believe the cargo was in danger of exploding. But some mention how illogical it would be. Even if there was an explosion, the chances of survival were still much higher on the ship than in the tiny lifeboat. These would not be the actions of a highly experienced captain like Benjamin Briggs. The lack of damage to the cargo and ship also weakens these theories. Next is Benjamin Bathurst. Benjamin Bathurst was a British diplomat. Disappeared in November 1809 at Petersburg. On November 25th, Benjamin and his assistant, Kraus, traveled by carriage and stopped at the town of Thalberg, west of Berlin. They ordered new horses for their carriage and walked to an inn, the White Swan, for an early dinner. Benjamin spent several hours writing in a small room at the inn, where he also burned some pieces of paper in the fireplace. Their departure was delayed until 9 p.m, when they were told the horses were about to be harnessed to their carriage. Benjamin immediately left the inn. Instead of entering the carriage from the side closest to the building, he walked around the horses to the far side. Kraus followed shortly after, and was surprised to find Benjamin was not in the carriage when he reached it. Kraus and some local men searched the area for an hour, but he was nowhere to be found. At the time, murders and robberies were so common that the loss of one traveller was barely noticed. The disappearance did not reach England for weeks, until Kraus managed to return. The village and nearby river was searched by authorities. 2 days later, on November 27th, Benjamin's expensive fur coat was found in an outhouse owned by a family named Schmidt. August Schmidt had been working at the White Swan Inn the night Benjamin disappeared. Years later, a woman testified that when Benjamin left the establishment, August had come in, asked her where the visitor had gone, then hurried after him. He may have been involved with the disappearance, although some think that Benjamin forgot his coat in a hurry to leave, and Schmidt took it after he vanished. On December 16th, two old women scavenging in the woods came across his pantaloons 3 miles from Pearlberg. Benjamin's wife, Felida, had the whole town searched using train dogs, but her efforts were to no avail. She then travelled to Berlin and then Paris to see Napoleon himself, hoping to obtain information of her husband's fate. However, Napoleon said he did not have any information of this and offered his assistance. Over 40 years later, during the demolition of a house in Pearlberg near the White Swan Inn, a skeleton was discovered under the stable. The back of the skull showed a fracture from blunt force trauma. All of the upper teeth were perfect, but one of the lower molars was removed by a dentist. The owner had bought the house in 1834 from Christian Mertens, who had been a server at the White Swan when Benjamin disappeared. One of Benjamin's sisters travelled to Pearlberg, but could not be sure whether the skull belonged to her brother. A Swedish architect, businessman, and diplomat who saved thousands of Jews during World War II. While serving as a Swedish envoy in Budapest, he issued protective passports and sheltered Jews in buildings designated as Swedish territory. In January 1945, Wallenberg was detained by Russian government on suspicion of espionage, and he subsequently disappeared. He was reported to have died in July 1947 while in prison at the Moscow headquarters of KGB secret police. The motives behind his imprisonment remain mysterious. In 1946, the Swedish ambassador met with Stalin and wrongly assumed that Wallenberg was already dead, so he ignored the offers of a prisoner exchange. The next year, the Soviet government released a statement saying he had died in his cell at night, probably from a heart attack. His body was then ordered to be cremated without autopsy. It was later announced that Wallenberg had actually been executed in the prison. Some claim he was poisoned and tortured. Other accounts say he was shot. There was no reason given for why he was killed or why they had initially lied about it. There were many who claimed to have met him during his imprisonment. Some former inmates even say they had seen Wallenberg after his reported death. An eyewitness said that she saw Wallenberg in the 1960s at a Soviet prison where she had worked. The last reported sightings of Wallenberg were by two independent witnesses who said they had evidence. He was in prison in November 1987. When he would have been 75 years old. In 1996, the CIA released thousands of documents relating to Raoul Wallenberg, which confirmed the long-held suspicion that he was an American intelligence asset during his time in Hungary. He may also have been involved in a separate task to undermine Hungary's pro-Nazi government, causing Soviet authorities to target him. The Wallenberg family successfully sued the Soviet Union over his disappearance for $39 million. However, the Soviet Union ignored the suit and did not pay any of the damages awarded by the judge. They also did not offer any information into his disappearance.
Ship to inform Captain Hart
Marshall, the second assistant, wrote of severe winds, the likes of which I have never seen before in 20 years. He also noticed that James Dugat, the principal keeper, had been very quiet, and that the third assistant, William MacArthur, had been crying. William was a seasoned mariner and known as a tough fighter, so why would he be crying about a storm? On the 13th of December, it stated the storm was still raging, and all three men had been praying. These were three experienced lighthouse keepers, safely situated on a brand new lighthouse that was 150 feet above sea level. They should have been perfectly safe, with no reason to worry. Also, there were no reported storms in that area on the 12th, 13th, and 14th of December. In fact, the weather was calm and the storms did not arrive until the 17th. The final log entry was made on the 15th of December. It simply read, "Storm ended, sea calm, God is over all." However, an investigative writer later reported that these logbook entries were fake and were added later to the story. Outside on the landing, ropes were strewn all over the rocks, which were usually held in a crate 70 feet above the platform on a supply crane. One theory was the crate had fallen down and the lighthouse keepers were trying to retrieve them when an unexpected wave washed them out to sea. But all three were very experienced, and the sea should have been calm, as the lighthouse was clearly visible by a nearby island. Also, no bodies were found washed up on the shore. The coastline of Eileen Moor is indented with narrow gullies called geos, and the west landing forms into a cave at the end. In high seas or storms, water would rush into the cave and then explode out again with considerable force. It was possible one of the keepers may have seen a series of large waves approaching the